We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Friday, November 22nd, and we are just a few weeks post-election and post the massive mandate that the American people gave to the Republicans and, of course, in particular, the Trump administration. And as we have seen this slurry of and just absolute rapid-fire pace of all of these nominees, we want to get to that a little bit later in the program. But first, one of the biggest clashes and really what the leftist media, of course, is panicking about is Trump's promise to deport millions of illegal immigrants, and not just violent criminals. Obviously, violent criminals need to go first, and in my view, at least, should have priority there. But anyone who has crossed the border illegally, if they don't otherwise qualify for amnesty, and of course, there are a lot of legal loopholes we could talk about, but by and large, it's just American law that if you are here illegally, then you should not be here. And so Donald Trump has promised that, and he has even said that he may engage the United States military to assist with deportation. So how exactly could all of this function? Well, joining us now to discuss is Nelson Bellido, who is the chairman of the Border Commerce and Security Council. So Nelson, let's start with just kind of this whole idea of mass deportations. How practically could Trump implement this starting on day one?
Jenna, thanks for having me this morning. You know, really what's happening is there's been already a lot of planning behind the scenes in hopes that there is a Trump presidency, which, as we know, the American people gave a mandate just a couple of weeks ago that this is exactly what they wanted. And the other thing that they'll say is that Trump campaigned on this, right? So, as you said, the leftist media is panicking, but this was a campaign promise. People voted for him. Not only did he win the popular vote, but the Electoral College. So there's no going back. That people are certainly not going to be surprised of what's happening, because this is something that he's been talking about for months now, if not years. So you look at what's going to happen is the first thing you need to build some housing, right? Where do you put these people? Where do you put these people once they are captured, and how are they captured? Well, they're captured in county jails, which we know there's thousands of them in county jails being held right now throughout the United States. There's a criminal offense. Let's say you're a loud neighbor, and you get your neighbor calls you, and somebody appears at your house to check what's going on, and they ask for IDs and identification, and they find out that you're illegal. Chances are he'll be at that point arrested, taken down, and processed accordingly. So the first thing is you got to look at housing, and then once you look at housing, you say, okay, well, who's going to do this action? You know, we have ICE, part of the Homeland Security Investigations. We have Border Patrol. We have U.S. Customs. We have, obviously, National Guard when we talk about military. And actually, the military has been playing a border role already. There are almost 5,000 troops on the southern border facing the U.S.-Mexico border that's managed by Joint Task Force North out of El Paso, part of the United States Northern Command. And most of these are reservists or National Guards members, mostly National Guard members, that are put on the border to be able to play roles in a non-law enforcement capacity, meaning these people are doing some research, they're doing some intelligence, they're putting up fences, they're keeping a watch on the line. They're doing a lot of things so that the agents, the law enforcement individuals that are deputized to do that, like the state police, like the Border Patrol, like U.S. Customs and others, can actually be in the field doing their work and not being sitting there processing people. So you use the military to supplement a lot of these roles, and you train them so that the agents that need to be doing their job in the field can actually go out there instead of being out there babysitting in a particular holding facility or something like that. So those are some of the things that I see that I see happening right now being planned each and every day and locations. We even saw Texas just a day or two ago just say, hey, we have 14,000 acres in Starr County. Starr County is west of McAllen, Texas, for those that want to have where it's at, west, about 30-40 minutes from McAllen, a lot of rural area, and it happened to be an area that there was a lot of crossings traditionally through there over the last few years, a lot of contraband going through there, but there's land there, and there's plenty to build. So Texas has already said, hey, we got a place. We can house a major location right here. Let's see what happens. I know from what I understand, some of the borders are Tom Homan and some others may be coming down to the border in the next few days to look at that and other things and have discussions with the state of Texas. I don't know where the main staging areas are going to be. I've heard there's a lot of going to be various camps throughout the country, maybe perhaps one per FEMA region. Would be a good idea, but ultimately you need a place for them to go conglomerate to and then ultimately get to a location or a major airport where they can be deported. And again, those things take a while because, you know, even though you capture somebody and they know they're in the United States illegally or have perhaps have overstayed their visa or perhaps they came in as asylumees like we've seen gosh, millions and millions and millions over the last 3.5-4 years, which 89% of them don't show up in court. So we believe them to come into the country. We believe them to they claim asylum, quote unquote, and credible fear, only never to show up in court because they can't prove credible fear, so they don't show up, get lost in America, and now their visa is an overstay. Those are now subject to deportation. So like that, we have millions. And actually, because the court dates have taken 3, 4, 5 years in advance, so if you cross today, and let's say they still have the catch-and-release policy, you may get a court date that's 3 or 4 years down. Why? Because there's a humongous backlog. There's millions of people waiting on this thing, and they're all supposed to get due process. So what happens is you get supplements, you get a temporary work visa, you get, you know, cell phone, you get a number of things that the Biden administration will give these immigrants to release them in the United States so they can, I guess, quote unquote, survive while they wait their time in court. But at the time they don't show up in court, now they become an illegal alien because their visa's expired. They didn't show up in court to be able to prove their credible fear. We're going to have millions of people like that, if not hundreds of thousands of people like that, per year coming into the rolls. So as they don't show up, they can be expired. And again, traditionally, 80, 90 percent of the people don't show up. So if 2 million people crossed last year, well, you can expect the majority of that, 1.8, 1.7 million people, at least 1.5, that simply will become a visa overstay and now are subject to deportation and mandate by the federal court.
And I'm speaking with Nelson Balido, who is the chairman of the Border and Commerce and Security, the Border Commerce and Security Council. And, all of these things are just a stark reminder that we have good immigration law. It's the enforcement of it by the executive branch that has really gone unchecked. And so there's a lot of these workarounds or, you know, these court dates that are 3 and 4 years out. And then, of course, these people who are just allowed to stay illegally pending their court date end up just never returning. And then there's really never any consequences unless they end up becoming or being violent criminals, like what we just saw in the Lake and Riley trial. I mean, that illegal alien should never have been in the United States to begin with, much less on a taxpayer chartered flight to the state of Georgia. I mean, it's absolutely absurd what this has come to. But you're absolutely right that the American voters voted for stronger border policy. I mean, I'm one of them. That was the key issue. I mean, a ton of other things. But to me, safety and security and national security in terms of the border was the number one issue for me this election. There's a lot of other stuff and a lot of reasons why I personally rejected the entire leftist cultural Marxism, but the border is the best place to start. And so what does the future Trump administration do, Nelson, with some of these mayors and blue state governors who are implementing sanctuary city policies and basically saying, well, too bad, Donald Trump, we aren't going to allow you to come in and actually remove people from our states?
Well, you know, that's sad because, again, probably most of the people and the polling show, whatever side you're on, poll show that most of the people don't want those folks in any city. So they're going against their own population. But what you need to do is simply cut federal funding. That's it. Just, you know what, if you're not going to help, what's going to cut federal funding? Or, you know, I don't know if there's a workaround, an obstruction of justice, or it could be a number of items. But the, you know, you cut federal funding, and I guarantee you all of a sudden they will perhaps stop doing that. I think their own population wants to do that. But the scary part about this, Jenna, is we've got to remember, out of the people that crossed, let's say 2 million people just last year alone, 20% of those, and there's an additional 20% that I know the Border Patrol and others, this is something in our community that's known widely, are what we call gotaways. So, yes, we have 2 million people that we know, but we know that there's another 400,000 people that what they call got away. They went through the border port of entry without any type of documentation, with never meeting an agent or interviewing or getting processed or anything like that. And those are the scary ones. Those are some of the folks that you see, the Tren Dará, the TDA gangs that you see, these Venezuelan gangs, which is not just Venezuelan. They're as they come up through the channel, they're recruiting Colombians, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and others. Yeah, they're based as Venezuelan gangs, but that's what happens is they come in and they start taking over. And I kid you not, they are everywhere. The cartels, the organized crime is a border agnostic. It starts south of the border and very much south of the border, not just Mexico. That's just another transient location, but sure, they're very prominent there. And they go into the United States. So the crime will continue unless these mayors and these other folks get on board. And I don't think their population wants that. And I think that needs to be pointed out, needs to be highlighted. I know Los Angeles, I believe just 2 days ago, voted as one of the first sanctuary cities. Well, you know, they got so many problems of their own with homelessness and everything else, so they're just exasperating the problem. That's unfortunate. But again, I think you got to cut the power of the purse. In many cases, and I think that starts pressuring them to do the right thing. But under bottom line is these people are criminals and they're in jail for a reason, and they need to be taken care of. And many of them that you know violated their visa mandate, you know, that are now here illegally, even though we believe them when they came in, you know, also have to be deported back, which takes a while. It has to be a lot of negotiation with the countries that are where they're going to be sending back. But the same way they put them on airplanes to come to this country, many of these, hundreds of thousands of them, the Nicaraguans, Cubans, Venezuelans, on these flights, like you said, tax-paid flights, they need to be sent back to the same location, express shipment.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And you're absolutely right that even the citizens and the vast majority of them of even these blue states are not in lockstep and not approving of what their own governors and mayors are doing. I mean, I know people from my former home state of Colorado who in the Aurora area where you have this the Venezuelan gangs that have come in. I mean, people in that area are not happy about it, and they're not happy that the Aurora Police Department isn't really authorizing their own police officers to do anything about this. They're not happy with the mayor of Aurora. There's a lot that's going on that even though, unfortunately, Colorado's basically become more or less a blue state now, maybe still tinging purple, that they're not in lockstep with what their own governors are doing. And so they need to listen to the voice of the people. But Nelson Bellido, really appreciate your insights, and we can only hope that Trump won't get bogged down in, you know, litigation and pushback from the left, and he'll actually get a lot of this border security done. Like I said, I think this is the number one issue that he has to address immediately for the safety and security of all Americans. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then, they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, in a stunning development late last night, Matt Gaetz, the former representative from Florida, withdrew his name from consideration as the nominee for attorney general in Trump's pick. And this was, of course, amid some very interesting meetings up at Capitol Hill. And reports have suggested that due to some of the controversy, and of course, you know, we don't know what is contained in the ethics report, but we know at least what the DOJ was investigating, and they never charged Matt Gaetz. But during the meetings on Capitol Hill, reports have suggested that he was one vote shy of the necessary number for Senate confirmation, and that was likely the reason that he pulled out. And Donald Trump, of course, wasted no time then in nominating a replacement, which is former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. So a lot of developments here, and joining me now to discuss all this and more is our good friend Todd Starnes, who is a radio host and also Newsmax host, and you can find all of his great work at toddstarnes.com. And also, of course, we always get his news breaks, and I like his commentary here at AFR. So good morning, Todd. And I think this was kind of a shocking development for a lot of people who at least assumed that Matt Gaetz would stay in the fight a little longer. What do you make of him withdrawing this quickly?
Hi, Jenna. For me, this was not necessarily a head scratcher. This is my working philosophy. This is my POV when it comes to Trump and this cabinet. He won a mandate. What he campaigned on, what he wants, he needs to get. So if Donald Trump wants Mickey Mouse for a cabinet position, he gets Mickey Mouse. No questions asked, because the guy's got a strategy. So there was ultimately, I think, a strategy behind all of this. Matt Gaetz is not very well liked on Capitol Hill by either side of the aisle. And even within the Republican circles, a lot of conservatives took issue with Matt Gaetz. Now, I want to say something about the allegations, because those are pretty scurrilous. And the reality is they're just allegations. They've been investigating him since 2021. He has never been charged with a crime. He hasn't been arrested. No warrants taken out. So until that happens, we have to believe in this country, innocent until proven guilty. But again, the DOJ took a pass on, you know, prosecuting this case, Jenna. I mean, you're the attorney, you're the expert on that side of the aisle. But it seems to me we've got a bigger problem in the country, in that people are now immediately declared guilty when somebody raises an accusation.
Yeah, I could not agree with that more. And that's also what's going on with current Secretary of Defense nominee Pete Hegseth, because there was an allegation back in, I think it was 2017, against him as well. And, you know, no charges filed, nothing materialized. And yet that has become a major issue, not just on Capitol Hill, but also in the media. And of course, the media is trying to amplify this. And this is, I feel like they're trying, the left is on purpose trying to use the same playbook that they hit Kavanaugh with. And they're trying to do that to undermine Trump's picks. And so this is not surprising for the left. They're going to try to use just allegations, bald allegations with no substance behind it, to try to take out picks that they don't prefer, like Matt Gaetz or Pete Hegseth. But the interesting thing to me was that these are four Republican senators that didn't back and support Matt Gaetz, and so he wasn't going to reach the threshold for confirmation. Is that something that Donald Trump needs to be concerned about? Because, I mean, we anticipate that from Democrats and from the left, but shouldn't Republicans at least go along with this country and innocent until proven guilty and at least support Trump's picks?
Well, they should, but they're not doing it. And the Republicans have a history of this. It was the Republicans who had control of the House and the Senate during Trump's first 2 years in office. And Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell fought him every step of the way. And I think this go around, there is going to be some blowback when those senators are up for re-election. I think Susan Collins and McConnell both probably, this is their last, this is their swan song, which means they don't care. So they are going to be a thorn in President Trump's side. That being said, I think we also have to talk about, the morality of the situation. Granted, we're talking about politics, and it's a cesspool. It's a swamp. There are ugly critters in that swamp. And I think that if you have been asked by the president to serve and you've got skeletons in your closet, you need to fess up immediately to the transition team so they can determine whether or not you're a salvageable nominee or not. Otherwise, you do great harm to the president-elect. And I think everybody, that's been nominated needs to do some soul searching. And quite frankly, I would recommend that Pete Hegseth and Matt Gaetz, no matter what they do next, my recommendation is maybe they should consider attending an American Family Association, family marriage seminar.
Well, that's always good advice, regardless of whether you're a Trump nominee or not. All of us can use some wholesome family values, and hopefully we can infuse the dirty world of politics with some of that disinfectant. This was really frustrating that it was Mitch McConnell along with three other senators, Murkowski, Collins, and Curtis, that were reportedly keeping Gaetz under the one vote threshold for confirmation. And absolutely, the vetting team, I think you're absolutely right, needs to know if there's anything that is going to be in the way. I mean, the left is always going to try to use something, but obviously there are some issues that may become a bigger deal than others. And certainly the controversy surrounding Matt Gaetz was very widely known. I mean, that didn't come as a surprise to literally anybody in the media, any of us who are just spectators to all of this, or of course the transition team. And so for Matt Gaetz, though, to withdraw this quickly, it had to have been such a hard no and no wiggle room to even hopefully convince one or more of the senators that were a no. And that, I think, is what surprised me the most, Todd Starnes, is that Matt Gaetz just, after kind of his first round of meetings, said, okay, well, this isn't going to happen, and I'm gonna withdraw, rather than going forward with the confirmation hearing or trying to get one of the recess appointments that Trump has talked about and at least start to do the job and then maybe hand it off to somebody else. I mean, I think that quick of a retreat was a little bit surprising, because it seemed like to a lot of people who were championing him as the selection that he kind of caved to the media pressure. What do you think that this was a wise move to say, listen, I'm a distraction now to the Trump transition? Because clearly he was the most firebrand and controversial pick. But at the same time, this may have ultimately lost to the Trump transition team some political capital to say, listen, you better take whoever I pick, including Mickey Mouse, who, by the way, is from the state of Florida. You know, he's moved. I know he's originally from California, but, you know, he's from the state of Florida, and Trump has been taking a lot of people from the state of Florida. So it could be Mickey Mouse pretty soon.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point. Look, you know, the one thing that didn't make sense in all of this, they said, well, he didn't want to be a distraction. The day his name was announced as the nominee, he became a distraction. So I don't think that was getting any worse. I think it really did have to do with the Senate vote. And they knew ultimately they weren't going to get those numbers. Even Mark Wayne Mullen out of Oklahoma had been mentioned as a fifth senator. And there were others that were leaning that way. So it could have been a really embarrassing vote for the president-elect. So maybe that had something to do with it, or maybe, just maybe, this is 4D chess, and President Trump is having a little bit of fun, maybe rooting out the rhinos. But again, as we move forward, and I know how my fellow Baptists, you know, think on things like this, they need to understand that Washington, D.C. ain't Mayberry.
Yeah, well said. And that's why I'm very glad to be out of D.C. and in the great state of Florida. It is really just a swamp out there. But let's talk about the new nominee. And so Donald Trump wasted no time in selecting a new attorney general nominee, which was not among the picks that had been floating and the names that had been floating around in the media. Pam Bondi, who, again, from the great state of Florida, she was a former attorney general here for 8 years, and she was also one of the lawyers on President Trump's first legal impeachment team. And so, full disclosure, I've known Pam Bondi for years. Personally, I think she's a great person. I've known her since the Trump's administration through AFPI and some of the work that she did. And we did jointly on Women for Trump. I got to know her and worked with her on the first impeachment, of course. And, you know, she argued on the floor of the Senate, did a masterful job there. I think she is a brilliant choice. I think that she absolutely is qualified, and nobody from the left, like they said against Matt Gaetz, can impugn her experience. So why do you think she is the pick rather than some of these other names that had been floated, like, an, you know, an A.G. Bailey from Missouri, Ken Paxton from Texas, or, you know, some of these other names that had been floated?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Paxton would have been a great pick, but he does come with baggage. And I think, you know, the president was very strategic here. Pam Bondi has I read a piece last night. They said that Pam Bondi comes with more legal experience than any other attorney general over the past 50 or 60 years. So she is a highly qualified candidate. And she's done a wonderful job. You know, Pam's been a good friend of my radio program. She's one of the regulars, and she's a fierce defender of the president. She's going to be a fierce defender of the law as well. And I think that she is going to be really tough in rooting out this this lawfare that sort of infested the Justice Department. But so I'm pretty excited about it. And also, and I just think this is funny, you know, they go after the president for being a misogynist. And yet here is a man who is appointing very strong, very intelligent, and dare I say, very beautiful women to his cabinet. And one last thing, Jenna, and this just kind of excites me, is that the folks on MSNBC last night were literally terrified that this woman is going to be the next attorney general.
Yeah, they were saying, you know, this, we have more to fear because she's actually very competent. And I'm thinking, if you're fearing competence, then maybe you need to do some internal soul searching here, because that's exactly what we would want from the head of the DOJ. So yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting, though, comparatively with a firebrand like Matt Gaetz, now you have someone who is a very strong, tenacious, experienced attorney who in in her own right has done a lot of media. You're absolutely right. I think, you know, Mark Cuban is the hardest hit with how many strong women Trump is appointing. And yet there have been some of the faction of MAGA that are, you know, online or commenting and all of that saying, well, she's fine, but, you know, we had hoped for a stronger warrior and fighter. I mean, kind of the firebrand that they were excited about from Matt Gaetz. But I would caution people, and tell me if you agree with this, Todd, that, you know, you don't have to be as bombastic as a Matt Gaetz and as much of a kind of bomb thrower to be that strong, tenacious warrior. And I just see a difference maybe in their fighting style, but I would certainly not ever say that Pam Bondi is less of a fighter or a strong pick for Donald Trump than a Matt Gaetz, because now there's this comparison.
Yeah, no, I think that's a pretty fair assessment of it. And again, with someone like a Pam Bondi, she's going to get the job done, and she's going to be very effective at it. And of course, you know, we still don't have the FBI picked, and that could, you know, that's going to be a very important role. So let's see how this plays out. Again, the person, whoever President Trump wants, the president should get. It doesn't matter if I like the person or not. The president has a plan. And again, these are not your traditional cabinet picks, Jenna, and people need to understand that. You know, in a lot of administrations, you have cabinet members that are going in and maybe creating their own ideology within the departments. That's not what this is. Every person Trump is picking is a disruptor. So they are going into, for example, the Department of Education, not with their agenda, but with Donald Trump's agenda. So that's why this is all very different. We've never seen anything like this in modern American politics. And it's really going to be fascinating to watch all this play out.
Yeah, and I think that that signals very strongly that Donald Trump learned his lesson from the first time around. And, you know, you and I were there, and you know, and I saw it up close and personal that some of his picks, who were the more traditional establishment Republicans who had kind of, you know, worked their way up in D.C., who came in with their own ideology and almost viewed it as, well, yeah, I serve at the pleasure of the elected, but, you know, does Trump really know what he's doing? You know, I'm going to execute the office. Or the duties of my office in the way that I think best, even if it conflicts with or clashes with what Trump wants to do. And that ultimately, I think, hurt him and caused a lot of not only distractions, but tension and clash. And he didn't get as much done in the first term, where this second round of selections, I think, has had that one common thread, that it's everybody who is very dedicated to his America First agenda. And you want that as basically a coalition of your cabinet and your executive. So it'll be really interesting to see. And we still have more cabinet picks to go, and the confirmation hearings, whether or not there will be recess appointments and all of that. But I've also been asked over, you know, the last 12 hours or so, quite frequently, what happens to Matt Gaetz now? So so interestingly, you know, he did resign his current House seat. He did include in his letter that he doesn't intend to take the oath of office for the 119th Congress that starts in January. Whether or not he could still go back and assume the office that he was elected to, I haven't really seen a very clear answer on that. Obviously, if there was a special election called, he could run in that. But there has been some speculation that he might be appointed either to the Senate from Florida in Rubio's vacated seat. I don't see that really as a possibility. Todd Stearns, I don't see Governor DeSantis choosing a Matt Gaetz over, you know, some of the other potential options. But do you see him possibly going in to the administration in a different role that doesn't require Senate confirmation?
Possibly. That is going to be an interesting development, because he could go back to Congress. He could be sworn in. So he's without a job, period. But he did win his seat for the next Congress. But if he does, then the ethics investigation gets, you know, relaunches. So that he's going to have to deal with that. And I'm not sure he wants to do that. But maybe he does, because, quite frankly, they're leaking all of the juicy parts of that to the media. So It's really up to Matt Gaetz. I mean, he could go back to Congress, or there could be another role, an appointment that doesn't require Senate confirmation, where he could serve in the administration as well. But the other part of it is this, and I hesitate to bring this up, Jenna, but the fact is that Trump could have been doing everybody a favor by basically sidelining Matt Gaetz for the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the possibilities that a lot of people have been speculating, especially because Gaetz did resign so quickly before he was confirmed. I mean, obviously, like Marco Rubio, for example, hasn't resigned his Senate seat. And because of the ethics report and some of that controversy, you know, that's where I think there may be some substance to that speculation. So we'll see how that goes. But in the last few minutes I have with you, Todd Starnes, and I really appreciate your time today because there's so much to talk about with all of these things. I want to get your take on this whole Capitol Hill bathroom controversy. I mean, this has been an issue that has, you know, is decades old, and we all remember boycotting Target about 10 years ago over the same issue. And now suddenly, because Delaware decided to send a man in a dress to Capitol Hill, now all of the sudden, we have to just say, well, of course, men shouldn't go into women's bathrooms. This shouldn't really be this big of a controversy. But where I see this as an issue is because the GOP has not stood strongly enough on the issue overall of human sexuality. And so when we're trying to draw a bright line to say, okay, well, transgenderism is too far, but, you know, we'll accept gay marriage, we'll accept, you know, so, some of these other, we'll accept, you know, abortion up until, you know, whatever week, or we'll be squidgy on it, then it's much more difficult to defend our position now. How do you see it?
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm glad that everybody's fired up over this bathroom situation. My concern is, why haven't they been fired up over the bathroom situation for middle school girls and high school girls? And I think we need to be just as ferocious in defending young, you know, these young girls on their athletic teams and in their locker rooms. You know, I was a little surprised by Speaker Johnson's original statement, where he actually took a pass. And I want to explain why. I know that he came back and he qualified his comments, and he actually got around to saying what he should have said in the first place, Jenna. But what concerns me is that's going to be his way of addressing the controversial issues. His first thought is not to speak truth to the culture. His first thought is to play nice, and we really do not need that in a leadership position, especially as Speaker of the House. And to be perfectly honest, when I heard him say what he said originally, I thought to myself, oh my goodness, did Mike Pence write that speech for him? that's just really way off the mark. So I'm glad that he circled back around to it. But I think the speaker really needs, somebody needs to have a conversation. We need to send Walker Wildman up to Capitol Hill, and Walker can say, Mr. Speaker, let's give you a tutorial. I'm yes. volunteering Walker.
Okay, well, I'll volunteer Walker for the speaker's comms director, policy advisor, and, you know, maybe a few other things. Yeah, because you're absolutely right. I mean, that should not have been a question that took him that much off guard. I mean, and again, I'm very glad that, and you're right, that he went back and said, you know, listen, let me reiterate my position, and he came out more strongly, and then, of course, with his statement. But that's something, I mean, if you're asked, you know, does the sun rise in the east, you don't have to go back and say, well, wait a minute, let me figure out my position on this. You know, I mean, it should be something that is just so obvious that you can respond with strength. And this is where the GOP has consistently had an issue standing strong on the social issues. Now, we've seen a lot of, you know, the border policy is strong, and mass deportations and some of these other things, the economy and all of that. But, you know, this Congress and also with some of Trump's advisors, even Trump himself, who doesn't particularly care as much about the social issues, that's going to be the weakest spot in the GOP that I think evangelicals and Christians have a lot of work to do still to encourage the GOP to return to morality in policy. How do you think we can best move forward with the new trifecta and how they're pretty weak on the social issues?
Well, they are. And I think it's going to be incumbent upon those of us, you know, that have the ear of the administration to remind them that it was evangelical Christians who came out in record numbers. And I talked about this yesterday on my Newsmax TV show. We had Timothy Head from Faith and Family Coalition. I mean, there are record numbers of evangelicals who gave Trump that victory. So we did our part this go around. And I think that, you know, I do think the president is going to be friendly to a lot of the issues that we are concerned about. I would say I'm concerned about RFK Jr., but he's sort of the wild card. I don't think he's going to be as much of a threat as a lot of the pro-life community thinks, but it is a concern. I absolutely understand why people are concerned about that. And most importantly, we have to pray. And, you know, I was one of these weird ducks through the entire campaign season. I was very hopeful and pretty encouraged through the entire process because it really didn't matter. The outcome doesn't really matter from a spiritual perspective. We're going to live our lives the way we live our lives. And, you know, would it have been difficult? Absolutely. But the reality is that God is ultimately in control, and we have to claim our peace and our hope in that.
Amen. Good word, Todd Starnes. Really appreciate you joining on a very busy news day Friday. So thanks so much, and you can follow Todd on X on all of these social media platforms, and of course, read all of his pieces coming from a Christian perspective at toddstarnes.com, and also his radio and TV show. He's such a busy guy, so we always appreciate it when he takes time to drop by here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning, and we will be right back.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And as we are continuing to talk about this mandate that the American people have given to the Trump administration and Republicans as a whole, this also includes not just divesting the government of its ability for wasteful spending and, you know, a lot of these other deep state and corrupt people that are in various agencies, everything with the new DOGE department, but also what Congressman Michael Cloud has talked about in terms of diversity and equity and inclusion policies. And he has now brought forward, and this is passed out of committee, what he's calling the Dismantled DEI Act that will restore accountability by eliminating DEI offices, removing mandates on federal contractors, and ensuring taxpayer dollars serve all Americans. This is what he said in committee earlier this week.
Diversity, equity, inclusion are three words that don't necessarily mean what we think they mean. And in spite of the altruistic motives of some of the purveyors of it, diversity, equity, inclusion, as it's been initiated in our federal government as an ideology, seeks to categorize individuals based on their immutable characteristics. It is a rejection of the principles that people should be judged on the content of their character and their individual achievement rather than their sex, race, national origin, or ethnicity. DEI is a huge step backwards for our country. It has taken generations, not to mention a civil war, a civil rights movement, to move past a stain on our nation's history. But we have made tremendous progress. But to codify discrimination in an effort to remove discrimination is a woeful initiative and would undo generations of progress we have made as a nation on this. Every tear, every drop of blood, the sweat of our founders, our forefathers that have fallen would be in vain for us to continue and to reverse the path that we have. True justice is blind. It should not consider race or sex. And it's the duty of us as lawmakers to write just laws, and it's the duty of the executive branch to be just in administering them without deference to race, creed, religion. Yet the Biden administration has pushed through DEI initiatives into every policy and government department. What this bill seeks to do is really three things. It seeks to close the DEI offices that have been set up in virtually every single agency. And as well, this federal government has pushed these policies and sort of force-fed them on the American population by requiring that anyone who does business with the federal government, contractors, also have to adhere to these DEI policies, as well as the grant writing process. So this would write what may be a well-intended policy, but has done great harm to our country. It's been very divisive. A new report from Do No Harm counted 500 DEI actions that the Biden administration took place or planned to take. DEI ideology simply does not work and only serves to divide our country. DEI ideology also results in absurd government-funded programs and has been a complete waste of taxpayer dollars and is dangerous, as sometimes people who do not have the competencies to carry out the job are placed in jobs for DEI reasons. It is time for us to unwind this bureaucratic initiative and to restore a functioning government that does not give preference to race, sex, or any of these characteristics.
So that was Congressman Michael Cloud in Congress earlier this week. And he's absolutely right that what DEI has become is not just trying to push for so-called equity across the board, which is to not discriminate against certain minorities or discriminate between the genders, but really what it has effectively done is codify discrimination against mainly conservatives, Christians, Trump supporters for our worldviews, our political viewpoints, our faith, and all of these things that we have seen from an absurdly weaponized government over the last 4 years. And so to dismantle all of these DEI policies goes well beyond just a de-weaponization of the federal government, but also to drastically reduce all of the things that our taxpayer dollars are going to fund. And so Congressman Cloud is actually joining me today on the podcast. And so we will release the latest episode of On Demand with Jenna Ellis at AFR.net. It's an AFR online exclusive. And we do a deep dive into this and where the spending is actually taking place. And I have to tell you, I was blown away by what the congressman revealed to me on this podcast. So for example, just to give you one prominent thing that was utterly, utterly preposterous. Did you know that our taxpayer dollars are going to fund drag shows in Bolivia? I mean, it's insane. And this is, of course, not a line item that says, you know, drag shows over in foreign countries, but rather, you know, humanitarian aid and projects funding the arts and all of these other things that seem very innocuous as a line item. But when you actually look at where the money is being spent and what it is being spent on, we are sending taxpayer dollars from Christian conservatives like you and me. Our taxpayer dollars are going to fund cultural Marxism, the LGBTQ agenda, under the auspices of humanitarian aid. That has got to stop. Not only is this a total waste of funds, but it absolutely contravenes any actual legitimate mandate for tax and spend. There is nothing that I voted on or that my members of Congress voted on, at least openly, to spend these kind of line items. And so to defund this type of spending absolutely has to be addressed. And so you are not going to want to miss the interview with Congressman Michael Cloud on demand on AFR.net. That is going to be posted today. And we do this deep dive. It is shocking, and we need to demand that Congress takes action to reverse this reckless spending under the name of humanitarian. And what are we doing? Spreading democracy? That's what we're suggesting? with these kind of expenditures. It's utterly absurd. I don't want my taxpayer dollars going toward it, and I hope that this new Republican trifecta gets to the bottom of it and will defund a lot of this utter nonsense. So you can find On Demand with Jenna Ellis at AFR.net. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.